forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny, unseasonably cold this morning, clearing in the afternoon. Today's high only 28. Perspective on that number, normal high this time of year would be 47. The record high was 69 degrees. We hit that November 13th, 1989, equaled it in 1999. Tonight, clear and very cold, overnight low 12 above. Wednesday, sunny and brisk, a high of 37. This morning, wind from the northwest at 8. Here are the current numbers. 19 degrees in Racine, 18 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's coming up on 8:11. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is no secret that all of our lives, in all kinds of different ways, have been utterly transformed by emerging technologies. And it seems like every day our lives are transformed still more. And although on some level we are all aware of this, chances are the vast majority of us are really not acutely aware of just how much our lives are being transformed. And not only that, not only what we do in our lives and how we do them, but how we ourselves perhaps are also being transformed in some very, very dramatic ways, perhaps transformed more dramatically and drastically than has ever occurred so quickly in the whole course of human history. One gentleman who has very, very serious concerns about how rapidly technology is emerging and changing us and our world is Dr. Ian I. Mitroff, who has written a new book called Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. Dr. Mitroff is actually senior affiliate of the Center for Catastrophic Risk Management at the University of California, Berkeley, and professor emeritus of the Annenberg School of Communication and the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California. So he is someone who was, in a sense, one of the co-founders of what is now known as crisis management, and works with all kinds of different organizations and companies when it comes to understanding the importance of crisis management. And one of the contentions in his book is that we have allowed technologies to emerge and be disseminated widely throughout our country without sufficient attention to the potential problems and without an adequate framework of crisis management in place to help contend with unintended consequences of some of these new technologies. Again, the book is titled Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And Dr. Ian I. Mitroff, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here. Perhaps I could give a few examples to make it concrete that it's well known there's a mounting body of evidence that the more kids, young people use Facebook, the lonelier, more isolated, the more depressed that they feel. And one of the reasons is that everybody presents an idealized portrait of themselves on Facebook, which is hard to stand up against the other idealized portraits. But let me give you a few more examples. Recently, MIT engineers have invented gold leaf tattoos, which place directly on our skin, that would allow us to communicate seamlessly with all of our marvelous devices. The problem is, again, not thinking about the downsides of this stuff, is that kids already sleep with their cell phones under their pillows at night, lest they miss an important text or email during the night. Now their skin's going to be potentially buzzing all night long. And so there goes uninterrupted sleep. And the point is that we don't think about the downsides of this stuff. Let me give you another example, since the examples mean so much. Recently, an experiment was done where kids were sent away to a detox camp for a week. And at the week, they were not to use their devices at all. So they went a week without using the devices. After the week, they were brought out of the camp, brought back, and they were compared with the kids who used their devices for the whole week. And the way they were compared is social psychologists gave them a set of pictures to look at and whether they could pick up on the emotions that people were expressing in the pictures. The kids who went away to the detox camp were significantly better in picking up emotions, facial recognition, than the kids who used it. Now, if that's only 1 week, we have to worry, what does a lifetime of exposure do to this kind of stuff? I mean, one of the things that, one of the books that I would really recommend that every parent, everybody ought to read, is by an MIT clinical psychologist, Sherry Turkle, Alone Together. And she documents the less than perfect effects of Facebook. And in effect, it's all but destroyed the art of conversation with young people, because there are no explicit rules or algorithms how you start a conversation, keep it going, and how you end it. So yes, technology has made our lives better in so many respects. We live longer, healthier lives. But here's the point. I know I have a PhD in engineering, so I'm not anti-technology. The thing that changed me is that I took a minor in the philosophy of science that, in fact, made me a social scientist, is that technologists get overly enthused, hyped up on all the positive attributes of the things they're creating, all these marvelous gadgets. They don't think about the downside. They don't think about how the things they're inventing will be both misused and abused. And we've just got to call a stop to that, because what's in the works is even worse. The most recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly described what people who work in artificial intelligence, AI, are thinking about. They're thinking about putting chips in our head. Yeah, the Department of Defense wants it so they can create a soldier that can go 48 hours without sleep and the rest. But to put that in our head, in fact, artificial intelligence will be inside of us, which raises the questions, who and what will be human? But the real thing to think about is the mind-body organism is so complex that we start messing around with that without knowing the full impacts. What in God are we creating? What are we doing ourselves? Because the people who enthuse about this, they call it evolution 2.0. Well, that's fine for them on the paper. But in effect, that we become the experimental animals that which all this stuff is being directed at. So those are my fears. It's not that we shouldn't have technology. I mean, we're a highly technological society world. But we need to have a better take on the possible abuses and misuses of this stuff before we just continue to dump the latest stuff on the world.
Right.
Anyway, I went a bit long.
That's
there,
fine. No, you're saying that frames things very, very nicely. And by the way, I was struck by the fact that over and over again in your book, you use the verb dump to describe the way in which many of these technologies tend to be introduced. I mean, they tend not to be introduced in a sense in sort of careful fashion or wary fashion, but in your words, are dumped into society, modern society, for us to use or misuse them as we see fit. I want to back up, though, to what you were just saying in terms of talking about technologists, those who are at the heart of the industry that is creating technology and sharing it with the world. You're making a serious charge there, suggesting that the vast majority of such technologists, those who are developing these new technologies, are not thinking about the possible adverse ramifications of those technologies at all. That's a serious charge. I mean, how many of them have you actually spoken to that you know that, or are you surmising that based just on sort of the means by which this technology is being shared with the world?
Well, it's both. I mean, in writing my book, I read a spate of books on technology, pro and con. And in the books, that it's not something I just throw out casually. You pick up, in black and white, it's stated that we have better things to do with our time. You know, it's predominant. The predominant way we spend our energy is inventing technology. I mean, some of the people I've talked with and say they call me a wet blanket. And I accept that. So it's not only that I've read scores of books, but over the course of my career, I've talked to hundreds of technologists. So this just doesn't spring out of anywhere. It doesn't mean that there are no technologists who don't think about it, but they have to be essentially prodded. I mean, if you look at what's happening, just take the issue of privacy, which is not the whole of what's happening. Okay, finally, Tim Cook is waking up, and even technologists realize regulations are coming, but they fought them tooth and nail, because one of the biggest parts of my book is something I call the technological mindset. After reading scores of books on technology, pro and con, what it's doing to us, I began to see there was a mindset driving technology. Number one in that mindset, technology is the solution to all our problems, including those caused by technology. We shouldn't waste our time thinking about the negative, because the positive things will outweigh that. People will always adapt as they always have before. I mean, when you read this stuff, it's an extreme, extreme belief system. Does that mean that all technologists hold it? No, but they hold a lot of the parts. And so that's why I use the word dump. It is a strong word, but I'll make it even stronger that Mark Zuckerberg is obviously smart and gifted enough to invent Facebook. I don't think he has the breadth of social knowledge and maturity to manage an organization of the complexity and the power of Facebook. I mean, it just about came out when it was in front of Congress saying they didn't look at the big picture. That's what I'm talking at. Looking at the big picture means looking at the unanticipated, the unacknowledged, the unpleasant, how things will be misused and abused. For example, there are no reasons, given my history in crisis management, prior to the launch of Facebook, if teams of kids, parents, psychologists had been assembled, I bet you the chances are very high they would have come up with the platform being used as a major platform for bullying. Now, what they would have done would have been another thing. So there are ways. Let me give you a dramatic thing that I talk about in the book, and this happened years ago. When I was at USC, I founded and ran the first academic center for crisis management in the world. So we had corporate sponsors who gave us money, but more importantly, gave us access to the organization so we could see how they manage crises. So one day, I went out on the road, and I visited a very famous pharmaceutical company. And I asked the guy who agreed to interview, to talk with me, what are you guys doing about product tampering, the main crisis that pharmaceutical food companies worry about? Without missing a beat, this guy said to me, we have an internal assassin team. I said, you have what? He said, yeah, one day we held up a bottle of our pills, and we looked at the cap as the front door of the house and the walls. How could the burglar get in and do the most damage, remain undetected for as long as possible? Well, we realized there's no such thing as tamper-proof bottle, but they came up with tamper evidence seals. Here's the point. This is one example of a very specific organization that really thought differently because they were attacked. In fact, it was the Tylenol poisoning. It was the maker of Tylenol, the company to whom I'm referring. I've used that example, that exercise, with a few other companies. But it's rare, because most people, when they invent this stuff, it's their baby. They don't want to think how their baby's going to be hurt. Well, the point is that if you don't do it, if you don't do the internal assassin team exercising yourself, I guarantee you somebody is out there trying to do it to you. I mean, again, look at Facebook, interference with our elections and hacking and all the rest of it. Well, so come back to putting chips in our brains. Can you imagine if somebody hacked into that chip, how it would affect our behavior? So those are the things that I'm worried about. And there are people who are starting to do the same, but we need many more people, in my opinion, in my judgment, to take this to the next level. In fact, what I'm calling for is this, that all these tech companies ought to be reconceptualized, relabeled media companies. And before they are given a license to operate, I would want to see that they have a good crisis plan. Will never be perfect, trying to anticipate and mitigate as much as possible all of the bad things that can happen to them. In fact, that's one of the things. If you have a crisis management effort in your company, you have a crisis management team, and their job is to come up with worst-case scenarios. So, yeah, I'm saying given the impact that technology has in our life, it's transforming. If you want to put chips in people, you're talking about, they call it evolution 3.0, you're talking about redesigning human beings. Well, that's pretty heady, and that's pretty impactful. Given the impact, I think we have to be just as impactful with safeguards.
We're speaking with Ionai Mitroff, who is the author of a new book called Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. I'm anxious to talk with you a little bit about the whole field of crisis management and what that would look like within the technology sector. First, I want to step back, though, and help our listeners understand some of the more basic topics that are also part of this book, which I think are really important, but which at a glance might not necessarily have anything to do with modern technology, although, of course, in fact, they do. One thing that you spend quite a lot of time in your book talking about is the whole matter of systems. And you say that, assuming our planet survives a couple more centuries, or that our human race survives a couple more centuries, that when historians, future historians, look back at our time, one of the things that we will be most roundly criticized for is our lack of systemic thinking. First of all, explain to our listeners how you are using the term system. And well, what it would mean if we approach some of these really important questions thinking systemically.
Well, let me back off, and I'll introduce two other concepts in which I talk about system. I talk about it in a very special sense in the book. I talk about in terms of something called wicked messes. A wicked problem is a problem that cannot be formulated by any one of these known disciplines or professions. So, for example, homelessness. Homelessness is not just an economic, but it's a medical, a public health problem. So it calls for a multi-pronged attack. The word mess, one of my philosophic mentors appropriated the word mess to stand for a whole system of problems that were so interconnected. The problems were so interconnected. You couldn't take any problem out of the mess without either destroying how you treat the problem and or the system. So we're in the world of wicked messes. I mean, just about everything, like ISIS, for crying out loud. It's a wicked mess. The interactions are so complex that we don't know all the things that happen. Like, for example, when you build an algorithm. When you build an algorithm, you don't know all the interactions, that all the different lines of code, what's going to come up. So a system is a series of items that are so interconnected that no item or no part of the system by itself can explain the whole behavior of the system. Again, I can go back to homelessness or the financial economy, whatever it is. So we are in the world of wicked messes. Now, the point about messes, you don't get algorithms. You don't get nice, neat rules. All you do is you cope with them. You just come up with heuristics, things that hopefully will work because, again, they're not fixed. See, most of us are educated in exercises like x plus 6 equals 11, find x. That's not the real world because an exercise is something which is bounded and structured. We're in the world of unbounded, unstructured problems. And we're not preparing people to think about those things. So that's the other part that's hitting technology, because a lot of times when we build these technologies, we assume, well, hey, we're putting it in a well-structured, it's well-structured, it's bounded. We can predict all its effects. No, we can't predict all its effects, which means we need a very different way of thinking. In fact, that is really the underlying message of my book. It's not just all the dangers of technology, but is our thinking up to the task? That's really, and that means a different form of education. So we talk about technologies and not just the different mindset, but we're talking about a different form of education. Now, given that I'm at Berkeley, did all my degrees there, I've taught an elective course for undergraduate engineers, and the kind of stuff you and I are talking about, I've taught, and the students I have are up for it. There are students who are looking for this different way of thinking. I'll do one other thing that pat myself on my back. Recently, my wife and I said, let's put our money where our mouth is. So we set up a scholarship at Berkeley. So why are we not? We're not going to wait till we kick off to give money to our alma mater. And the scholarship is for this: to help support students who are interested in the social impacts of engineering. In fact, what I'm really calling for is a social impact analysis before any technology is released, unlike an environmental impact assessment. So we have to do better social impact assessments of the stuff that we are unleashing, dumping on the world, so we can hopefully get out in front and not let this crisis pile up, but that we can be more proactive. I don't know whether I've answered your question.
No, it's very good. And by the way, I appreciated that when you talk about wicked messes and wicked problems, you also share the term tame problems and tame messes to describe opposite,
right,
which is when problems are bounded and structured and in a sense more predictable and easier to deal with. You tell us in the book that that there are too many of us who, when confronted by a so-called wicked mess or wicked problem, will engage in something called splitting. And there's nothing, you know, particularly ominous about that term right on the surface, but that in fact, when we engage in this kind of mental splitting of a problem, we are doing something that can really lead to harm. Explain to our listeners this term of splitting and how it relates to this.
I happen to have a background in psychodynamics. And one of the key people there is a woman called Melanie Klein, and she's incredible. Melanie Klein lived early in the 20th century, contemporary of Anna Freud. And what it said, if Freud discovered the child in the adult, Melanie Klein discovered the infant in the child. So she went pushed back even further, understanding human behavior. And what Melanie Klein discovered, under the age of two, the child typically splits the mother into a good mother, bad mother. Good mother is there to serve the child and meet its needs just when the child demands it, whereas the bad mother has to not punish the child, but has to set down rules and regulations and can't be there all the time. So it takes about 2 or 3 years before the child matures enough to realize the two mothers are one and the same. So there's a good and bad side to everybody. The problem is that in times of great stress, which we're living through now, some form of splitting emerges. So we sharply divide the world into good and bad forces. Well, it plays out in technology. When I went to school, the form of splitting took, there were good, hard subjects, and there were soft, bad subjects. So engineering was hard because, again, it was bounded structure and you got real hard quantitative answers. And management, humanities, oh, those were soft, just, you know, rife with opinions and the like. Well, that's dangerous because that means you don't take management seriously. See, I'm not surprised at all that when technologists create a company, they're not necessarily thinking about management or building crisis management in from the very beginning, because those attitudes still largely dominate in engineering schools. I know I've been around them. They even dominate, sadly, I taught in a business school my whole career. They even They're just rife throughout all of academia, and it's time to abandon that. Management is as hard, certainly as difficult, as critical as any particularly ethical management. And what I'm really talking about, we're talking about, is the ethical management of technology. We're not going to get rid of it. That's not the point. The point is, can we make it serve humankind? Because if we don't, technology becomes one of the greatest threats. C.P. Snow, distinguished British writer, scientist, said, put it this way, technology is a queer thing. It brings you great gifts with one hand and stabs you in the back with the other. So we want to cut down on the stabbing. We want to get the good of technology. We want to be out in front and thinking about and doing everything we can to mitigate the potential side effects and unacknowledged and unanticipated stuff that can happen. And that's the task, the supreme task facing us.
We're speaking with Dr. Ionai Mitroff. He is author of a book called Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
I sure do.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I'm enjoying
this.
By the way, early in the book, you quote an author who I interviewed on this program, Nicholas Carr, author of a book called The Shallows, which talks about the way in which potentially the Internet and the way we use it is changing not only us, but our very brains and the way we think. And the quote, I believe, of Nicholas Carr in your book says, "The influence and impacts of technology are more pervasive and invasive than ever before." I thought that was a really interesting way to think about it, because I think because it's happened so quickly and so dramatically, it's also easy in a sense to take that very fact for granted. And it's clearly a fact you don't take for granted at all, and you want all of us to be thinking much more about that. Of course, the problem is you're talking about technologies that in certain cases we're somewhat helpless to hold at bay. More and more, it is technology that, in a sense, is an inescapable part of life in the modern world. What is your... go ahead.
Let me put it this way. One of the things I'm also calling for in my book, and I think it's time, is that we need a new government agent. With all the problems of government, it still is the thing that serves the public good. So it's our job to reform it, like the Federal Drug Administration. I'm calling for, the design of a new government agency that oversee technology, that would require, before a technology is released, a part of that would be a crisis management plan. Yes, I know that's an encumbrance, but here's the point, that one of the things that came out of my work and others in crisis management is really significant. Those companies which are prepared for crises, which invest in crisis management, turn out to be significantly more profitable, experience fewer crises, get back to work faster than those companies that are just reactive. So crisis management is not only the right ethical thing to do, but it's good for business. Now, that's hard often to sell people, but we have the data to show that. So it's the right thing to do, and that's what I'm talking about. So I would want, yes, I'm calling to make it mandatory, because what happens now is we tried self-regulation with tech companies because they fought tooth and nail. That's another part of the technological mindset, is that all regulations must be fought tooth and nail. Well, we see the effect of that. It doesn't mean that crisis management is perfect. Nothing created by humans is perfect. But we do the best we can to manage what we can, to look at the possible ill effects, and do everything in our power to hopefully counteract them. And that's what I'm really, really... So it's a different way of educating technologists. Let me put it another way. When I talk to students, I say, hopefully you will dual major. If you're in engineering, you will dual major with some humanities and vice versa. We need integrated people to manage in the kind of complex world we have. And now, could everybody do it? No, but everybody can be exposed, because that's that's what's happening. So I hope that will happen, and that's why I wrote my book, to help move that along.
Hmm. I think it's really important for our listeners, and me for that matter, to come to a better understanding, maybe a more sophisticated understanding, of this term crisis management. And in particular, because you are using it in a way that talks of proactive versus reactive crisis management. And I think most of us, when we hear the term crisis management, think about some terrible thing happening and then figuring out what to do and sort of ordering and organizing the reaction to whatever this catastrophe is that overtakes us, whether it was sort of self-inflicted or not, or just an act of God. But I think most of us think of crisis management as something that happens after the fact. And you are using the term crisis management in a very different way, and also using it in contrast to another term, risk management. So let's talk first about crisis management.
Let me spend a little bit of time on that. Risk management and crisis management are not the same. They're interrelated, but not the same. In risk management, you look at the probability that something can happen, and you multiply it times its consequence, so you get a probabilistic event. So like what a bad thing could happen, how many people might be harmed, killed, and what's the cost of it. And then you rank things. Crisis management doesn't do that. Let me tell you what it is essentially. What I discovered early on, my colleagues and I, what we discovered was that there are very different types of crises. There are financial crises, there are HR crises, there are ethical crises, there are technological crises. And what happens is that there are environmental crises, breakdowns, and all. What we found, if you look at, like, say, BP spill in the oil spill in the Gulf, no crisis, or Wells Fargo, no crisis is ever a single crisis. A crisis may start in one category, one type of crisis, but it quickly spreads to involve other crises. It sets off a chain. That's why I talk about systems. Now, here's what the best organizations do. Not a lot of them. Maybe when we've done our studies and the number holds up, maybe only 10 to 15% of companies at best are proactive, 85% are reactive. But here's what the proactive do. They go into each of the different types of crises, and they look at a worst-case scenario. Because you're an oil company, you don't discount product tampering. You say, oh, we don't make food, until you say, wait a second, you guys have gas stations. Well, yeah. You sell food in there. Oh, yeah. So you do have product tampering as a potential crisis. So what you're doing is encouraging a proactive company to say, take a look at each of the different types and say, what's the worst case scenario, how it could happen to you, and how can you prepare for it? And then look systemically how a crisis that starts in one category could set off a different type of crisis in another category. And then another part of crisis management, one of the biggest parts, is looking for early warning signals. Long before every crisis happens, there are early warning signals. Not always, but in the vast majority. So if you can pick up in the early warning signals, which means you have a crisis management team in the organization, which is always looking for signals of a pending crisis, the best form of crisis management is to head it off before it happens. So this is, it is a different way of looking at it. And it's saying now, look, tie it in with quality assurance, because if you prevent these stuff, you're more profitable, and that's the point. And that's the way I'm looking at crisis management. But let me give you one last part that is even deeper that most people don't know. Here's what a crisis does. It not only exacts the financial a huge financial loss in the company, numbers of people killed, bad publicity, and loss of customer base. But it does something more insidious. What a crisis does, and why it really hurts people, it destroys in one fell swoop all the assumptions you've been making while you thought you'd never get into a crisis. So if you go back to Oklahoma City in the 1995, I believe it was, where a federal building was blown up by an American terrorist, Here are the three assumptions that were blown up, which is why it became an existential cry. One, terrorism only happens in Europe, not in the heartland of America. Two, an American won't act as a terrorist against his own own people. And third, worst of all, innocent men, women, and worst of all, children won't be killed because there was a daycare center in the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. So you can go through crisis after crisis. And you can see one of the most insidious things is the blow-up of your belief system. We can all function if one or two of our beliefs are proved invalid, but not if the whole thing crashes. And that's part of being proactive, seeing what are the assumptions that you are making about yourself and your business, why you won't have a crisis, or why you will survive one. And now tell me what you're going to do if that assumption proves to be invalid, because that's what the bad guys out there are counting on. They're counting on that you're not going to be proactive, because whether they have a beef or whatever, somebody comes in and shoots up a company or whatever, all the things that we've had happen in recent days. So that's what I'm talking about. It across my whole book, the same message is that we have to change our way of thinking. The world in which we now live is so vastly more complicated than any point in human history. We're not dealing with bounded, structured exercises. We're dealing with wicked messes. And we just have to grow up and face reality, and that ain't easy to do. Facing reality is one of the hardest things that humans ever do. But I hope my book helps to serve that. In fact, I'll say that the current book, I've written 37 books. I love to write. I love to do what I do. But this is one of the most important things I've ever done because of the impact of technology that it has in its life, its importance. And I want us to manage it better to our benefits, for the benefit of humankind, so it's not one of the greatest threats facing humankind.
Right. And when you outline for us what you see as the typical technological mindset, which is very likely the basic mindset of most of the people driving our technological innovations, one of those points is that of complacency. The fact that so many who are in this field enjoy tremendous early success, which you say tends to lead to a kind of a combination, I suppose, of complacency and overconfidence. And so I think what you're suggesting there is there is kind of this inherent tendency not to be thinking about the negative ramifications that might be ahead for a technology that is about to be introduced to the public.
Well, yeah, Facebook is the poster child for this. I mean, it weathered cyberbullying. It weathered it's being used as a platform until finally it built up, and that's the point. Yeah, you go along and it breeds false confidence. Well, we got through that. We were reactive. We didn't blah, blah, blah. I didn't have to think about it. In fact, I know all the rationalizations because I've studied them over the years, why people in organizations say, well, we don't need to do crisis management. Oh, it's too expensive. Oh, it'll take us off for, you know, what we need to do. Oh, we're so big and powerful, nothing bad can happen to us. Oh, the crisis will be small. It won't affect the whole organization. And in fact, what we've done in our research is the following. The more rationalizations that a company has as to why I think it won't have a major crisis, the more that it is setting itself up for a really big crisis to happen. And in fact, the more crises that happen to an organization. We've done the data. It's not cause and effect, but there's a strong correlation. So the more that a company is investing in crisis management again, significantly more profitable it is because it's not losing money in a crisis, and the fewer crises that it experiences. It still experiences crises. No one can be crisis-proof, but they've learned to recover faster. So it's not just a nice thing to do, well, I think we'll do it. No, it's critical. It's essential, not only to the company, but to our society as a whole.
I would like to just briefly push back just a tiny bit when it comes to Facebook.
Okay.
I'm just, this is my point slash question. First of all, you know, as you talk about what Facebook failed to acknowledge or anticipate, I guess that's what I'm really saying, that their failure to anticipate where all of this might have gone and the potential pitfalls and so on. In some ways, it reminds me a little bit of the catastrophic fire that occurred on the ground that killed the Apollo 1 astronauts, the three astronauts, when a fire erupted in the capsule while it was still on the ground and all of them were killed. And what ended up being released in the investigations afterwards was that that possibility just never dawned on anybody, any of the brilliant minds at NASA, that such as they had thought about every kind of other emergency, but never a fire happening on the ground. It just never dawned on them. And it was, I think most people looking at that would not, even the families of the astronauts would probably not say that was a matter of negligence. That is a matter of the human imagination has its limits. And I, in some ways, although it's a very different thing, Facebook feels a little bit like the same thing. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Mark Zuckerberg as a human being, but on the other hand, I guess I find myself able to forgive them for not understanding where all of this was going to go. Can you just...
Let me comment. I mean, you're right about the astronauts. But the clincher is this. You said that they had tried to think of as many things as possible, so we can't fault them for not thinking of everything. Look, one of the most important subjects I ever studied as a technologist was philosophy of religion. And it may sound weird, but it is probably the best thing that one could do to really engage your mind and help you think about complex problems. And what you do in philosophy of religion, the arguments pro against the existence, pro and con the existence of God, they're so torturous. If you can survive that, you can survive just about anything, because it prepares you for thinking about really complex, messy problems in systems. It's not that you have to be perfect. The point about philosophy of religion, there's only one entity in all of human existence that has all the attributes of perfection, and that's God, G-O-D. We ain't got it. But that's the point, is we do the best we can. So I'm not faulting Facebook because it didn't prepare for every crisis. I'm faulting it because it didn't do crisis management at the beginning. It wasn't factored in. And that's, importantly, that too bad is, you know, like the way a lot of technology companies operate, because they're so enamored. In fact, part of the technological mindset, they overly hype the positive aspects of what they're doing. I mean, Facebook has a superficial notion of what it means to connect. So, you know, I'm not faulting them because they didn't come up with everything in the world. I'm faulting them with something more basic that I hope other technology companies would learn. In fact, people have said, is it time to reinvent a socially responsible Facebook? Let me give you an example for me, which is damning. Facebook has employed facial recognition technology to pick up on kids who are really vulnerable, depressed, low self-esteem, and then sold that data to other companies who could prey upon them with products and stuff. That's reprehensible. I mean, that is so unethical to me. I'm talking about stuff like that, that, okay, they may not have been able to pick up on everything that happened to them, because, we can't expect perfection. But what we have a right to expect is that, like the Apollo astronauts, at least you're doing everything you can to think about what could happen. That something misses, yeah, again, we're not perfect. But that's the point I'm making. And when you have an organization like Facebook that has such, talk about pervasive and invasive, you know, there's no excuse left. You know, it's like what it would take. I don't know what it would take. It might be hopeless in Facebook, given the culture, to go back in and talk about what a socially responsible Facebook would look like in that particular company. But hopefully what we will learn, in fact, that may be my next book, talking about what a socially responsible tech company would look like. And one of the things it would do, it would have crisis management embedded in it right from the very beginning. It would be seamless.
Hmm.
Not perfect. That, because that gets, if we start demanding perfection, then everybody just eyes glaze over and it becomes impossible.
Right.
Because
that's a...
we know how to set things up where we can damn ourselves, and that's not what I'm talking, or make something impossible where people say, oh, that can't be done, therefore we can't do it at all. Uh-uh. That's one of the rationalizations, in fact, that we study at companies who don't want to do crisis management. They set up this super... goal or condition of perfection, since nobody can reach it, and say, well, see, no need to do it, and say, no, you did it the wrong way. You're not thinking about it in the right way.
Hmm. And briefly, when it comes, for instance, to Facebook, and Facebook's, of course, not the only guilty party here. That's for sure. But it's a good example that most of us understand. As far as you know, I mean, neither you nor I were inside any of those rooms as Facebook was first being created, and of course it remains a largely secretive company. Is it that they simply didn't care? I mean, and just didn't even go into any of these areas of, or is it that they were just not very good at, or was it that they just weren't good at it?
There was recently, I haven't watched the second part, but there's been a two-part series on PBS, on Frontline. And the first part is, and the two parts is about Facebook and why it didn't do the kind of things we're talking about. I don't think it's not that they didn't care. It just wasn't on their radar screen. It wasn't in their mindset. That's the point. It wasn't in their thinking. So it's like, it's not that they dismissed it, that kind of thing, but it's like, again, it's not everybody who goes into technology. They're interested in the technology. Look, the technology is so alluring. It's so powerful. It's an addictive drug. In fact, a lot of these things are designed to be addictive. There was a 60 Minutes, maybe 6 months ago, where a guy who left Google, and he left Google because he was tired of beating his head up against the wall, saying, you guys are designing apps that are addictive, particularly with kids, and he couldn't get them to change. Look, I have an iPhone. Of course, I'm addicted to it. I have a computer and all this stuff. I'm a techie. It's not like I'm some kind of purist here saying that, oh, you guys do it and I don't. No, I do the same thing. You know what? I can't remember the group that designed something called sleeping bags for iPhones, that kids put your iPhone to bed for the night, and families are saying no cell phones at the table. We have a grandson who lives nearby, and the parents are insistent that you have to pay a fine if anybody takes out their cell phone. But here's the point. You can't just put that all on parents, because the parents up against some of the most powerful tech companies in the world don't have the same degree of power. That's why I want them to enforce crisis management. I want them to do the right things and not just leave it to a group of disorganized parents across the world to have to do it. So to come back to your question, no, I don't think it was one where they said, oh, we don't want to do it. I don't just think it was in their radar screen to begin with, because
right,
most people don't think about it.
Right. Well, thanks to your book and, of course, the writing of others, this is beginning to be a more significant concern on the radar screens of more and more people, and your book is an important part of that. The book, again, is Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age, published by Palgrove Macmillan, the author, Ian I. Mitroff. Dr. Mitroff, thank you so much for making yourself available for this conversation. Your book gave me a lot to think about, and I enjoyed our conversation very much.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation as well, not just an interview, but I take your points well, and thank you again for having me on. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Tomorrow, a very special morning show that I hope you'll be able to listen to. We're going to be commemorating the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. That anniversary, of course, occurred this past weekend. I'm going to be replaying excerpts from several memorable morning show conversations about World War I. Historian Robert Laplander, best-selling authors Andrew Carroll and Patrick K. O'Donnell. That will be tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between